Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott.
I'm Marek Swoboda.
Marek Swoboda is an engineer who runs a small startup called RightAir. For the last 2 years, he's been working on designing ventilators for COPD patients. That's a chronic lung disease. Then in March, a Philadelphia hospital approached him to ask if he and his team could create basic ventilators as a backup during this pandemic.
We are part of something I would call Plan C or D. And they turned to us and asked whether we can build something for them in a very short period of time. And they said, can you do something in 2 weeks?
The hospital wanted 500 devices. Marek thought, no way.
2 weeks, 500 units, completely impossible.
But they got to work. They looked around to learn what was already out there. They brainstormed, tried and tried again.
It was a great sprint, design sprint. We've done it in 5 days. In 5 days, we were able to test the first prototype.
Okay, so we have 45 centimeter of water on our input. The peep valve is working nicely. The lung is working. So check, check, and check.
They came up with a very simple ventilator that can be 3D printed. Patients have to be intubated.
And it creates positive pressure to create inhale and exhale actions.
So it does the work of breathing for the patient.
Yes, and that's the biggest concern right now, that the work of breathing becomes so huge that they cannot do it on their own.
The ventilator is small and connects to pressure lines that Marek says are standard in hospitals.
Now we can connect it to the high pressure.
The design will be available to anybody who wants to print it. The materials cost about $10.
And then you have to assemble it using a glue gun in probably 10 minutes.
Now, this is not an FDA-approved medical device. It could only be used in very specific situations, if there were no other way to keep a patient alive. But Marek is proud of what they've created in such a short period of time. You came up with this solution in a matter of days, and that's probably very different from how you usually work and what your process is usually like. So what was that like, just having this pressure and then saying, go?
Yeah, I hate this process, to be honest with you. it's very painful. On the other hand, most of R&D engineers work very well under pressure. I don't know why. But it's a rule. I spent 25 years doing this, and my teams always work best under pressure. Actually, this timeline helped us to focus.
Sometimes we do our best work under pressure, like the kind we're facing right now. But other times it seems like pressure and stress scramble our brains. On today's episode,
this is your brain.
And this is your brain in times of a pandemic. What spurs creativity and what optimizes brain function? The coronavirus crisis is spurring a lot of scientific advances, new testing methods, vaccines, and tools for healthcare providers.
When people have nothing to lose, then risk doesn't really play a role.
That's John Cunios. He is a professor of psychology at Drexel University in Philadelphia and wrote a book called The Eureka Factor: Aha Moments, Creative Insight, and the Brain.
Imagine that you're an early human on the savanna in Africa, and you're looking off into the distance, and way off in the distance, you see a lion. Well, what are you going to do? You can't make a mistake. If the lion sees you or smells you or hears you, you're dead. So you have anxiety, you go into a particular mode of thought, which we might call analytic. In order to not make any mistakes, you think through everything you're going to do in a very careful, deliberate way to avoid mistakes.
So some people are channeling the current threat and stress into a hyper-focused mode. You're not overthinking things, not looking at every single possibility or option out there. You choose a promising path and you take it. But John says usually breakthroughs happen when we're relaxed.
People tend to have these eureka moments when they're in a positive mood, when they're feeling relaxed and secure and sort of enthusiastic but peaceful at the same time. That's when these eureka moments are most likely to occur.
Feeling relaxed and peaceful is probably not exactly how many of us would describe our mental state right now. But still, lots of people want to optimize this time of social isolation, make the most of it.
I'm trying to do NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel Writing Month. Basically, you write a novel in a month, like 50,000 words.
What I try to get the most out of from being indoors is just being productive as much as I can. So I could be either painting and drawing, doing daily exercises from videos on YouTube, and meditating during the night or early morning.
I'm spending quarantine by trying my best to stay occupied with schoolwork.
But we also see stuff on social media like, stop trying to be productive. It's enough just to get by. It can feel like a constant push and pull. Relax, it's fine to do less versus get off the couch, start a new project, get to work. But a growing body of research finds that doing nothing or even letting yourself be bored is crucial for cognitive health. Steph Yin has more.
Lisa Pradhan is 28. She's a community organizer and multimedia artist living in Oakland, California. Being productive and finding meaning through work have always been really important to her.
I really internalized at a young age that I needed to do the most. And I think I really set up a series of ways of relating to work and productivity and self-worth where I was really pushing myself to the limit.
In high school, Lisa was one of those kids on the AP honors track, and there was a certain culture to that.
I think by being a part of that, I really surrounded myself with kids who were pushing themselves really, 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 really hard.
In her junior year, the stress caught up with her. She had to take time off school.
Because I just started getting super sick and no one knew why. I just started having all this pain, and at the time it felt like my body was falling apart.
But Lisa came back and pushed herself even harder in college, taking 7 or 8 classes while working multiple jobs and volunteering.
I'm still feeling this feeling of like I'm not doing enough.
After college, Lisa worked a full-time job by day. By night, she worked on her own art and joined efforts to build up art spaces for Asian Pacific Islanders and queer folks of color in the Bay Area. She'd go to community meetings, apply for grants, or work on a project for a show until late. Sometimes she'd forget to eat. Not only did this always-on lifestyle take its toll on Lisa's body, it was also emotionally and psychologically draining.
When you're stressed out all the time, it's really hard to show up in the world in the way you want to.
But Lisa didn't know how to stop or what to change. Then in 2017, 2 major incidents happened back to back. Lisa was assaulted in a violent attack. She asked to take some time off from work and a few days later was laid off from her job. She doesn't think her request for time off was related to the layoff, but the timing stung. It was a breaking point.
It's like, you know what? I've been doing all these different things in my life and it hasn't brought me happiness. Like, it hasn't brought me joy. It has just made me feel really tired all the time. And I just like gave myself permission to not do anything for a while and to just focus on like having energy and focus on mending myself.
A lot of us go, go, go until we can't. We keep pushing ourselves to the limit. We don't know how to rest. Experts say this impulse to always be doing something may be especially strong for younger generations, starting with millennials, who grew up in a hyper-competitive culture of scheduled extracurriculars and college prep, not to mention lots of screen time. Every moment of the day had to be filled with activity or stimulation. Now, as working adults, the effects of hustle culture are starting to catch up to many of them. Some have even given these effects a name, millennial burnout.
So this has, for years, long been a hobby horse of mine.
That's Tim Herrera. He's the editor of Smarter Living, a section in the New York Times that gives tips for how to live a better and more fulfilling life. And he's a big proponent of doing nothing.
It's been ingrained in us that we need to subscribe to hustle culture and always need to be maximizing productivity and always be monetizing our hobbies, and everything should be for the purpose of career advancements and all this. And I think it's poisonous and really destructive to our own happiness and our sense of identity. And in a more practical level, it's destructive to our overall productivity.
Smarter Living has published a lot on this topic over the years. Articles with titles like The Case for Doing Nothing, Work Less, You'll Get So Much More Done, and one of Tim's favorites, Take Naps at Work, Apologize to No One. He does, by the way, take naps on the clock, and he's become something of a nap ambassador for the rest of the Times' newsroom.
It seems like a very American idea to look down on people who take breaks throughout the day and who like need a nap at 2 p.m. And culturally, we are trained to see idle time as almost a character flaw.
But Tim is steadfast in his belief that we need more idle time in our lives. And he says the science backs him up.
The research and scientific evidence is perfectly clear, very unambiguous. We know this is how to be more productive. And, you know, you could read any book on productivity, talk to any expert, taking time for idleness and to daydream. Everybody who knows what they're talking about sings the praises up because we know that they work.
One of those experts is psychologist Doreen Dodgen-McGee. She says the obsession with productivity has made us averse to boredom. Doreen worries that many of us can't even wait in line a few minutes without pulling out our phones. She says that's a problem because it seems our brains actually need to be bored every now and then.
The prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that is responsible for things like attuned communication and starting and stopping behaviors, self-reflection and self-knowing awareness, is a part of the brain that really is stimulated to create robust wiring in the absence of other stimulation.
Meaning the brain requires some level of boredom for neurons in the prefrontal cortex to fire and create new connections. The prefrontal cortex plays an important role in emotional regulation. It helps us have what Doreen calls an internal locus of control.
The ability to soothe ourselves and come back to center rather than always needing to be stimulated or held by things outside of us.
It makes sense. Being bored lets us learn how to be content without distraction. Doreen says once you know what that feels like, it's easier to return to it. The calm within yourself becomes like a muscle you can use when things aren't going as well.
So it just helps us develop these really beautifully important psychological traits of grit and resilience like nothing else does.
On the flip side, when we're cognitively taxed all the time, we have trouble regulating our emotions. We're faster to anger, less able to weather frustration. Researchers have also found that the ability to tolerate boredom is linked with creativity.
There is the idea that when we allow ourselves to be idle, it increases the likelihood that we will become uncomfortable enough that we will get creative with our surroundings or even just creative within ourselves to find ways of having meaningful experiences.
Doreen says when she talks about idleness, she doesn't mean taking a break from work to scroll Instagram. She means resist filling the moment. Let your attention drift.
Just sitting and looking out of a window or sitting on one's porch and watching as the day goes by. The Dutch call this Niksen, N-I-K-S-E-N, which means doing nothing deliciously.
But Niksen feels unproductive, right? It could even make you feel anxious or guilty. Why is that? Or conversely, why do we care so deeply about being busy and productive all the time? Sylvia Bellezza has a hypothesis. She's a professor of marketing at Columbia University's Business School, and she studies status symbols. She became interested in our obsession with being busy because of a contradiction she noticed. In her field, the classic idea is that leisure time is a status symbol. An American economist named Thorstein Veblen wrote about that in the late 1800s.
He talks about the idea that the extremely wealthy people are the ones who can afford not to work.
But all around her, Sylvia saw pretty much the opposite.
You see that people are bragging all the time about working nonstop, even when you're supposed to be on holiday, bragging about the fact that you're working.
Sylvia thought today being busy is the status symbol. She tested this out a bunch of different ways to see if it was really true. For example, she created fake Facebook profiles. One profile would be filled with posts about working nonstop, being super busy. The other would have posts about having tons of free time. Then she asked study participants to rate the profiles. Do you think this person is wealthy? How would you rank their social status?
The person who's working all the time is seen as higher status than the person who's engaging in leisure.
But this was only true for participants in the U.S. When Sylvia did a similar experiment with Italians, she found the opposite.
For the Italians, as soon as they see the person who's not working, they immediately think of the person is well off. That's why they're not working.
Sylvia then looked into why participants in different countries felt the way they did.
What we find is that in countries like the U.S., in which people really think that through hard work you can make it to the top of society, we find that in those countries, being busy at work and being a workaholic is typically seen as very positively.
Doreen, the psychologist and boredom ambassador, tries to push back against this type of mentality.
If we have very, very stressful work environments, then learning the practice of taking even 3 minutes to do some things like breathing and let my mind kind of wander, even those tiny moments can go a long way toward soothing the self, even in very demanding conditions.
Doreen recognizes there's an irony to the work less, you'll get more done argument. She worries it reinforces the very productivity mindset she's trying to fight. For instance, she says, think of the trends toward quantifying leisure. Now, the simple act of going on a walk can become all about tracking your step count.
A lot of the mindfulness apps now or meditation apps will tell you the number of minutes that you have meditated and where you are in the global standing.
That matters because researchers have found even simple tasks of monitoring, like asking people to check off shapes that they filled in a coloring book, can counteract the replenishing effects they would have gotten from coloring aimlessly. That's why Doreen says unwinding has to be its own reward. Do nothing for the sake of doing nothing.
That story was reported by Steph Yin. We're talking about getting our brains to function at their best during this strange time of social isolation. And coming up, thought experiments gone wild.
Science doesn't care if the questions you're asking it are ridiculous or not. You could run through all these materials that would make sense to build a pool out of, like steel or fiberglass or wood. But the equations work just as well for materials that wouldn't make sense, like Gruyere cheese.
That's next on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Right now, we're all dealing with new problems and different situations. Working from home, taking classes online, everything has changed, and our brains are trying to adjust. What helps the brain function at its best? How do we think about creativity and productivity right now? Earlier on, we heard from an engineer who designed a simple ventilator for hospitals in 5 days. And he said what helped him get there was to stay on a very straightforward path. only pursue options that hold some promise. But if there is no time pressure, what about the opposite?
Well, I'm always thinking of other ways that you might do things. Like when I have some problem and it's like, okay, there is an obvious way to solve it, but I think, well, what about this other way? Would it work better? And the answer is almost always no, it wouldn't work better.
That's cartoonist Randall Munroe of the popular webcomic XKCD.
But it's sometimes fun to take an idea that seems completely ridiculous and try to think through it and figure out what would actually happen if you tried it.
Randall is always thinking through crazy scenarios. For example, moving. Why pack everything into boxes and then you have to unpack it all later?
And so I started wondering, could I just lift up my entire house and carry it to where I'm going and then move the stuff directly? And that got me wondering about how you lift up a house, and is it possible to make a house fly if you have enough helicopters?
Is that how you think about the world most of the time or just sometimes?
I think I'm always, you know, trying to think of what would happen if I did this. It's like anytime you sit in front of a button and you just think, well, what would happen if I pushed this button, you know? And I sort of think about it that way. Like, one of the things that to me is really exciting about doing science and about, you know, math and stuff is it's cool, but to me it's not just exciting for its own sake. It's exciting because, like, I'll sit there and wonder, like, I'll look at the moon going by and, you know, think, like, how often does that go in front of a star? What if you made it crash into something? Is it ever going to crash into anything? You know, what would happen if it fell into the sun? Like, you can ask all these questions.
And Randall doesn't just ask these questions. He really gets into the research. He's an engineer by training. He has a degree in physics, so he does all of the mathematical equations. He creates formulas. He maps everything out. I talked to him last year when his book came out. It's called How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. He covers things like how to charge your cell phone if there is no electrical outlet, or how to power your home if you live on Mars.
It wasn't like I started out trying to think of only ridiculous or bad ideas. It's just a lot of the ideas I have turn out that way when I try to think through the consequences.
Maybe tell me about the pool party. I've always wanted to have a pool. And you have a chapter on how to have a pool party when you don't have a pool. So how do you go about having your pool party anyway?
You know, you obviously need a whole bunch of water and somewhere to put it. And that got me thinking, okay, well, could you dig a hole really quickly and then fill that with water? And then the other possibility was building an above-ground pool. And that seems a lot easier to construct. You know, you just need, probably a lot less material. And so I started figuring out, like, if you just put up a tarp, you know, in a circle shape with some fence around it or something, how strong would it need to be to hold in all the water? And I was surprised to, you know, sit down and do the calculations. I'm like, water is really heavy. And so I worked out equations for, like, how thick a sheet do you need around the pool? Like, how thick do those walls have to be to hold the water in? Because if they're too thin, the pool will just burst and all the water will flow out. So I came up with this equation for, like, here's how thick a fiberglass pool wall needs to be. Here's how thick it needs to be if you're building it out of wood to contain the pressure of the water. But one of the fun things for me about doing physics is you can plug any variable into those equations. So instead of putting in the tensile strength of fiberglass, I looked up, like, the tensile strength of different cheeses.
Right.
And so, found out how thick a cheese wall would have to be to contain a pool full of water.
So how do you get to that? So not only are you trying to build a pool where there is no pool, but then you're building a pool out of cheese.
Yeah, I think it's fun. I like that science doesn't care if the questions you're asking it are ridiculous or not. Like, they give you the answers either way. So I just like that you could run through all these materials that would make sense to build a pool out of, like steel or fiberglass or wood. But the equations work just as well for materials that wouldn't make sense, like Gruyere cheese.
So how much Gruyere cheese do you need to build a pool?
It's one of the stronger cheeses. I found this wonderful book on the cheese rheology and texture, like this authoritative handbook of cheese properties. And the cheese I picked was one of the stronger ones. But even then, you need a fairly thick wall because water is just so heavy.
So it said, what, 60 million calories?
Yeah, the pool wall, yeah, it would be fairly thick, like, you know, a couple of feet. And so then I couldn't resist figuring out how many calories that pool was. But also that water would just be really gross.
And that's a 3 feet deep pool, right?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, you could probably fill the pool with wine and make it a really fancy, fancy affair.
Right, because you already have the cheese
exactly.
there, too. Is there value in doing this kind of whimsical, silly thought experiment? I think we get trained from an early age to think about things that matter and to focus our energy on things that have outcomes. And here you are spending all this time just running through these thought experiments just because you want to do it. But is there value in just that, in letting your mind wander and doing that kind of work?
Yeah, I think so. I think for one thing, that same math, you know, applies to very real practical things. And so this is kind of a fun way to show how you apply that math to a new problem. And then you can go on and apply those same techniques to, you know, real problems that do matter. But it's also, I think, good to be a little bit humble when approaching ideas and not be too sure that you know whether or not they matter. Because there are ideas that sound great and then turn out to, you know, have some huge problem with them or, you know, to turn out to be ridiculous for some reason or another. But then there are also ideas that sound terrible, but then actually turn out to work really well. Like the whole idea of penicillin, you know, which is a product of mold, basically. The idea that if you had like an infection and you'd want to put some mold on that. Like that seems like a terrible idea, but it turns out to be revolutionary. Then there are all kinds of examples of these, of things where I'm like, that can't possibly be how that works. You know, oh, that wouldn't work, I'm sure, for some reason. And then you sit down and go through it and you're like, oh, you know, this actually might work. And so that stuff can surprise you. So I try to stay humble about like being sure that I know what matters or what ideas are good or not.
That's cartoonist Randall Munroe. His latest book is How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. We're talking about optimizing brain function. Some people are turning to devices that deliver a small amount of electrical current to zap their brains into gear. You can buy these things online. Some of them look like goggles, others like visors, and they claim to do everything from improving focus, memory, and productivity to treating anxiety and depression. These devices come out of a field of research called neuromodulation, which explores brain stimulation. Doctors use it to treat the symptoms of Parkinson's disease or serious depression. But should people be doing this at home? We sent reporter Liz Tung to find out more.
This is how Dave describes the device that he says changed his life for the better.
About the size of a cell phone or smaller, probably more like the size of one of the older flip phones that we used to have. Feels like something you could make if you were in the parking lot of a Radio Shack.
Dave is a school psychologist. He has said I only use his first name to protect his privacy. And he's dealt with anxiety and depression for most of his life. It hit an especially rough patch last summer when one of his therapist buddies recommended something novel, cranial electrotherapy stimulation, delivered by a little gadget that he could use right in his home. Dave was skeptical, but he was also getting desperate.
I didn't believe him. I thought it was going to be a bunch of snake oil. And so I said, well, you know what? At least out of my respect for him, I'll try something.
So Dave went looking online and found a similar device on eBay. It was called the AlphaStim and marketed as a, quote, FDA-cleared prescription medical device that offers relief from anxiety, insomnia, depression, and pain. So Dave ordered the device. A little while later, it showed up at his house. It had two parts, a little box that resembled a digital clock and a long, skinny cord, similar to cheap headphones. Except instead of two earbuds, it had two small clips, through which Dave discovered the device would deliver a microcurrent of electricity directly into his brain.
You clip it on your ears with a little bit of conducting solution, and it starts to send very minor, teeny tiny shocks through your earlobes. And then you turn it up. So it starts off, I think, at 100 microamps, and you kind of just turn it up until a point where you feel uncomfortable. It feels like being seasick, a little bit nauseous. And then you turn it back down just under that threshold.
The sensation was kind of disconcerting, but then something amazing happened.
All of a sudden, I had the motivation. I got up and I demoed my whole bathroom and started that project. So it was definitely one of those situations where I was like, wow, I feel different after the first time trying this.
He says it's not like he felt euphoric or anything. It just made him feel like less of a raw nerve all the time, which meant he no longer had so much resistance to getting things done. And in general, just felt more resilient.
I found that it's kind of like the threshold between feeling normal and feeling anxious was not as sensitive. You know, as you walk around in life and you're feeling vulnerable and someone says something or something and it just kind of sends you off and you get that rush of anxiety, that just didn't happen as often.
It actually seemed to work. So Dave kept using it, but he couldn't help but wonder, was it really the alpha stim or just the placebo effect? And if it was the device, how did it even work? To try and find out, I turned to Roy Hamilton. He's a neurologist and director of the University of Pennsylvania's Brain Stim Center. And he's been studying neuromodulation for more than 20 years. He says from the beginning, he just fell in love with the field.
I was immediately hooked by the notion that you could take something like a magnet and electrode and not only explore and understand how people think and what the neural basis of thought is, but also that you could manipulate and intervene on those thoughts and behaviors.
Neuromodulation is based on the observation that our brains run on electricity. Our brain cells use electrical signals to communicate with each other. That's what we're talking about when we say our neurons are firing. The goal of neuromodulation is to affect how and whether those neurons fire by targeting specific brain circuits. Roy says there are two commonly used kinds of neuromodulation. The first one is transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS.
It's transcranial because you're going through the skull non-invasively.
And it stimulates by creating a magnetic field that passes through the brain, causing your neurons to fire. It's FDA approved and pretty widely available for issues like depression. The second kind is the one Dave tried, transcranial electrical stimulation, which uses electrical currents. Basically, you stick at least two electrodes to different parts of your head, at least one anode and at least one cathode, and run a small amount of current between them. And going from one set of electrodes to the other, that current passes through the brain. It's much, much, much lower, by the way, than what you'd find in electroshock treatments.
That amount of current is nowhere near sufficient to cause neurons to fire acutely, to fire in that moment. But what it does is it takes large numbers of neurons and nudges them a little closer to or a little farther away from their thresholds for firing. So because of that, what is thought to happen is that you're going to manipulate the rate of firing of large numbers of neurons in the areas through which this current is passing. In the right circumstances, that can have influences on the behaviors that are relevant to those areas of the brain.
Over the last decade, researchers have found evidence that neuromodulation can be effective for lots of different issues. So while Roy says he gets Dave's skepticism, he says neuromodulation has been subject to some pretty pie-in-the-sky claims. He says it could very well have been what improved Dave's symptoms.
It is certainly possible that what has happened is that he's had some benefit in his symptoms as a function of having received stimulation. Really, it's stories like his that are exciting and motivating to the field with respect to developing these kinds of interventions as therapies.
But why are people doing this at home with devices they ordered on eBay? After all, neuromodulation started out as a research tool. Dave, who remember is also a therapist, says neurostimulation is far from mainstream.
It's very fringe. In my line of work, when you come across something that seems really effective for yourself, and there's just nobody using it, nobody recommending it. I mean, it's like, why is that?
Roy, who's been working in the field for over 20 years, says he's wondered the same thing.
It blows my mind still to this day that we can manipulate and change human cognition from the outside in a safe way using magnets and electrodes. Right? Why don't more people know that that's a thing we can do?
Roy says part of it might have to do with there being less money in neurostimulation, as opposed to, say, big pharma.
There's just far less of a bully pulpit for getting the word out and for pushing high-profile, high-throughput studies to the point where we can develop the applications at the rate that is done when we talk about pharmacology.
That slow speed has given rise to an active community of brain stimulation enthusiasts. They're trying this approach on their own outside of medical offices, like Dave. There's even a growing community of people making their own devices. Roy says a lot of researchers dismiss or turn up their noses at the DIYers, but he thinks they should be paying attention, even trying to work together.
If individuals are going to be engaged in these kinds of activities anyway, it's better if they have some understanding through experts who are working on this on what the potential risks are, what the potential benefits are,
and how they can use what one another are learning to improve their own practices or technologies. Thankfully, Roy says the risks they know of are pretty low. There is a tiny risk of seizure with magnetic stimulation. And even though some devices might not do what they promise, some of them will. Though he added, we shouldn't all flock to eBay to buy our own devices.
Before I make it sound as if my unwillingness to give blanket disapproval is equivalent to a blanket approval, it isn't, right? So, you know, it's very hard. It's sort of a wild west, and it's certainly in some of the devices that are out there with respect to understanding, you know, whether a specific one is good or not.
Because, Roy says, there could be risks that we haven't even thought of. Plus, he says, we need to do a lot more work before we figure out the most effective way to use neuromodulation.
That story was reported by Liz Tung. A lot of people are home right now, trying to be productive, creative, or maybe even trying to solve some part of this coronavirus puzzle. And that got us thinking about brain function and what it takes to reach our A game. There's this special place our brains take us sometimes where we lose ourselves. The words are flowing right from your brain to your keyboard. Maybe you're creating a song, an equation, a painting. You're in the zone, or you've achieved flow. What is flow, and how do you reach it? Reporter Jad Slayman looked into it.
What happens in our brains when we're in that flow state, that absolute laser focus? Belgian neuroscientist Guy Charron wanted to find out, and his experiment started with a man on a tightrope.
For a tightrope, it's very clear. If you do a mistake, you fall.
There's a video. You can see the walker set up on one end of this cable, set up in a town square, maybe 30 feet off the ground. He's wearing all white except for this red and black cap over his head with all these wires coming out of it. It's an EEG, measuring his brain electricity. The performance was perfect. One foot following the other, eyes forward, balance pole held firm, until about the halfway point. For some reason, the line attached to the walker's safety harness snagged, stopped him in his tracks.
He need to go backward and to sit on the cable and to solve the problem. We are lucky.
Guy calls this little snag lucky because of how it showed up in the brain scan data. To anyone watching the performance, before and after the hitch, it didn't seem to change at all.
Because he stayed in equilibrium, no problem. He worked at the same velocity with the same timing.
But the EEG brain scan told a different story.
After he meet some difficulties with the carabiner, which remained blocker, this induced a stress at this moment. And after this moment, it is a little bit preoccupied by the rest of the performance.
While his feet kept landing in the right place, the walker's headspace was all wrong. He had been pulled out of the flow state. And this gave Guy some information on where flow lives in the brain.
It's linked to different area in the brain, which are activated at this time. And this network we are discovered, arrive only when you arrive just close to the flow state.
His research is probably the most cutting edge looking at flow today, definitely the closest to measuring flow within the body. But folks have been chasing the flow state in some way or another for a long time.
Arguably, people have been experiencing and chasing flow states since, I mean, the beginning of time in certain respects, even old ancient spiritual texts.
That's Ryan Doris. He's an executive at the Flow Research Collective in California. They partner with universities and businesses, do a lot of flow state consulting and training. There's blurbs of praise from the likes of Bill Clinton and Elon Musk on their website. Ryan tells me the term flow state was coined only in the 70s by Hungarian-American psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. Mihaly had actually been studying something closer to happiness. Basically, he'd look at a vast, varied pool of people.
From Navajo sheep farmers to factory workers to musicians.
And he'd ask these people, what were the moments where they felt at their best? A common thread was the same weird state of timeless immersion in some task.
They all found themselves achieving this state where things felt, quote-unquote, flowy, where time dilates, action and awareness merge, concentration goes through the roof, you become totally and utterly absorbed in what it is that you're doing, and the experience feels literally flowy.
Mihaly found a correlation between overall life satisfaction and time spent in flow states. More recent research has shown positive effects on mood and cognition up to 3 days after a flow state. The Flow Research Collective is trying to essentially bottle flow, commodify it in large part for execs and entrepreneurs, make it closer to something you can induce on command. Though, don't expect to be able to actually, like, buy a bottle of flow.
A lot of people ask about, you know, is Adderall the same as a flow state? Is taking some kind of stimulant like that that does massively heighten focus, is that the same as a flow state?
No, apparently you get the focus of a flow state, but you miss out on the creativity of one. There's a kind of disinhibition in flow states that allows for more wild thinking.
So your normal sense of self, your sense of I, your sense of you being the one doing something has gone offline, and other elements of the brain are more active.
Maybe unsurprisingly, folks have also looked as well to psychedelics for a chemical flow state, psilocybin, LSD. Ryan says it's a maybe, but we don't know enough. Our understanding of the neurochemistry of flow is kind of like a half-written recipe. Ryan says researchers know some of the ingredients.
For example, dopamine is associated with creativity in different respects, and creativity heightens during a flow state. Serotonin is obviously associated with positive mood and positive affect, which also obviously increases in a flow state.
So does norepinephrine.
Norepinephrine is a focusing mechanism. It drives attention into the now.
But Ryan says no one knows the stack, which comes first, which comes last, and why, how they cascade through the brain. So there's the brain chemistry. But Ryan mainly focuses on psychological and physical triggers that could take us to flow. He says there's 22 of them.
These are preconditions for flow that need to be achieved in order for you to get into a flow state.
For example, focusing on narrow, well-defined goals. Think, play these three bars of music. Not play this entire sonata. And the next is what he calls the challenge skills balance.
So to put it more simply, if the challenge level of a certain task slightly outstrips your current skill set, you're more likely to be able to get into flow.
Start practicing a sonata that's just slightly more complicated than the last one you mastered. Ryan wants to bring flow into the workplace. So I give him a hard challenge. How can you make a data entry job flowy?
Let's say it's boring as hell, and time is, a day feels like a week or an eternity.
His words, not mine, data entry specialists.
Maybe with data entry, if the challenge level is always so low that the job is just so painfully boring, it's going to be pretty damn hard for you to drive yourself into flow. What you could do is you could artificially induce a deadline on yourself.
Like, say, I'm going to shred these 50 Excel rows in under 5 minutes. Time me. It's one strategy. And it's not like data entry is ever going to be as flowy as, say, snowboarding. Ryan and his team are chasing the flow state from the outside in, trying to create conditions at the workplace that make flow possible. Guy Charron, the neuroscientist back in Belgium, he's doing the opposite. Change what's in your head to get to flow.
The flow is not a beatitude. Eh? It's not like a yoga attitude or wellness. No, it's linked to action. What we need is a motor activity.
Physical movement.
The first condition of the emergency of flow is a perfect movement.
When you measure electricity in the brain with an EEG and electricity in the muscle with an EMG, you see a perfect synchronicity before flow. The muscle does exactly what the brain tells it to. This could be the perfect keystroke on your computer, the perfect tennis serve, the perfect pull on a sewing needle. This gets you moving toward the flow state.
But the reverse is not true. It's not possible to go in flow with a bad movement. It's impossible.
Think back to our tightrope walker. After his cable snagged, his movements were still perfect. He was a pro. He didn't fall. But his headspace was all wrong. He was second-guessing, self-conscious.
Be thinking about what you are doing. Some stupid feedback inside of your brain, you know.
So Guy is trying to develop tools to help people track flow and get into the right mental state for flow.
You do BCI, brain computing interface.
BCI. The technology has been around for about a decade. A BCI rig measures the electrical activity in a user's brain and marries it to a computer display in real time. If Guy's measurements of flow get precise enough, he can one day have a computer guide a user to the flow mindset, showing him warmer, or colder, depending on how they're thinking.
You must know what is your brain when you are in the flow. And then the computer knows that and it can indicate to you where you are.
There's a great deal of science chasing flow. But neuroscientist Heather Berlin tells me we can also flow without all that. She found her flow in painting.
In college, I was pre-med and taking all these sciences, but then I was like a fine arts minor and would just like paint at night. And it was good for my science. Like being able to get into those flow states, I could think more creatively about the kind of data, you know, that I was looking at.
And she studied flow for years.
So I quote the eminent philosopher Marshall Mathers, aka Eminem, with you have to lose yourself in the music the moment you own it. You better never let it go.
Eminem and his hit Lose Yourself. She says we can learn a lot from this song.
And I think he perfectly describes that getting lost in that state.
She says if you want to flow, chase that. Figure out what you can get lost in.
Maybe for someone it's knitting or, you know, going just for a walk in nature. And whatever that thing is, you know, make time in your day, allow time in your day to go there and to like allow your mind to be free.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slaman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.